There we go. Recording in progress. And so here's the questions. Oh yes. Wait, I wanted to get one book. I was going to read one thing from this book. So there's a bunch. A couple of these I can ping through rather quickly. From Rachel. Hi there. I was wondering if I'll be offering any dream yoga retreats. Yes, I'm doing one in Spain. Come join me in a place called Hidden Paradise. I'm also doing one in outside of Aspen in the Bayou Retreat Center. Also, are there any scholarships? Oh, yeah, so this is more techie thing. Scholarships or volunteers. You know, I will respond to you directly behind the scenes because I don't have control over this sort of thing if I don't host the event myself. So Rachel, I will ping you a direct response to see if I can help you with that. But instances where I'm not hosting an event, I don't have a ton of control over those. I'm a guest, but let me see what I can do for it. Okay, from Jimbo. When starting out on your dream yoga journey, is it okay to use the beginning stages of your journey to use lucid dreaming to pursue your desires in an ethical way, of course, and work through your desire systems before diving deeper into the more spiritual transformative work? Is this a legitimate way to start your dream yoga practice, or should you focus just on the spiritual stuff from the beginning? It's a good question, Jimbo. Yeah, so you can totally do that, but that's not dream yoga. That's lucid dreaming. And again, there's nothing wrong with lucid dreaming, but this is one of the things that distinguishes lucid dreaming from dream yoga. And if you are familiar with my listing of the 9 stages of dream yoga, stage 1 is in fact just this: do something fun. And I think this is actually, there's nothing inherently wrong with this. I often do this, like before I go to work, so to speak, in the dream, I'll wake up. And because I love to fly so much, I love flying in my dreams. It's like, this is the coolest thing. And so I will often just go for a little joyride, you know, zipping around, flying through the Grand Canyon, dive bombing, scaring people on the streets kind of stuff. There's nothing wrong with that. But here's the deal. It's not going to wake you up. It's just entertainment. But if you're confined, if you're a prisoner, if you're a paraplegic, if you're literally handicapped in that regard, this type of escape is actually a very powerful thing, and it should not be dismissed. I'm not dissing it at all. It has a place, but it's not dream yoga. But the thing to understand here, Jimbo, is that wherever intention is involved, even at the level of a lucid dream, if it's not lucid, it doesn't matter. That's just the exhaustion of karma. You're not creating karma. You're exhausting it. But if you're in a lucid dream and intention is involved, karma is created. And so therefore, when you insert it in an ethical way, that's the really important thing. You know, safe, clean, fun, whatever, with relatively pure intentions. I mean, if you go in and you're playing some wild video, you know, like a video game, just crazy cognitive mental game, you know, that's not the best thing. But if you're going to have some fun, you want to enjoy it, that's fine. The reason I say this is because you want to maintain a balance with your dream yoga curricula. It is a yoga. It is a practice. It does take some effort. But if you try too hard, then you're going to lose the inspiration to do it. So having a little bit of fun on the front end, I do this a lot. Really, I wake up in the dream. Oh, cool, lucid dream. I do my little dive bomb thing. And then I go, okay, time, enough of that. Then I go to work. So doing that is totally okay. Is this a legitimate way to start your dream yoga practice? Yes, but it's not official dream yoga. It's still lucid dreaming, but that's cool. Should you focus just on the spiritual stuff? Not necessarily. I mean, if you're inspired, sure, it's great. But, you know, not too tight, not too loose. Otherwise, this stuff is just like, I don't want to do this stuff. It's too much work. So have fun with it, right? If you really enjoy it and have fun, it's a cool thing. Okay. All right. In his book, The Tibetan Yogas of Dream and Sleep, this is from Marion. Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche, who I interviewed back in January. What a wonderful man. Podcast is on Edge of Mind. He's up there. Also in my club. Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche talks about samsaric dreams as well as dreams of clarity and their origins. Yes, he does. He also talks about dreams of clear light. Samsaric dreams I get all the time. Yes, we all do. All our dreams are, I'm going to run commentary as we go through these. Samsaric dreams are the default dream. That's just the residue of all our samsaric thinking and patterns and whatnot. So regular standard dreams are samsaric dreams. Can you expand on the difference, the differences between dreams of clarity and samsaric dreams? Yes, I can. So again, just what I said, samsaric dreams are kind of like what they sound. It's just your samsaric habitual patterns, what are called bakchak, latent tendencies, just expressing themselves. Dreams of clarity are, they're still samsaric dreams. Dreams of clarity are still samsaric dreams, but they're really good ones. They're that borderline, that liminal type of dream. And that now the dreams are filled with more positive karmic traces, positive bakchak. Dreams of teachers, dreams of teachings, that kind of stuff. And you will notice as you progress on your dream yoga path, because dream yoga was the moniker, the measure of the path, dreams will tell you where you are. Basically, the more you do the stuff, the less samsaric dreams you have, the more dreams of clarity you have. You have less and less violent dreams, bad dreams, nightmares. Eventually, nightmares stop, all the bad stuff stops. That's an indicator, a sign that your unconscious mind is being purified. You'll have more dreams of teachers, more dreams of the Dharma, more good dreams, more uplifted dreams. Those are dreams of clarity. Now, the one dream, just you don't mention, I just mentioned it parenthetically, what are called dreams of clear light. These are the highest level of dreams, period, until all dreaming stops. At a certain point, when the unconscious mind is completely emptied and exhausted, the eighth consciousness, when that's empty, dreams stop. Dreams. At that point, you're not dreaming. Or another way to say it, everything is seen to be a dream. That's the same thing. This now seen is seen as a dream, manifestation of mind. But dreams of clear light dreams are the highest form of dream, which is where the dream is immediately mixed with the clear light. Those of you who know these terms, this is the union of generation and completion stage practice. And so for those of you who do that level of tantric practice, you can measure that in your dream. You start having a dream that is infused with the clear light at its outset. That's the very highest type of dream. Can you expand on the differences? I think I just tried. Excuse me. In particular, with examples of dreams that arise from transpersonal karmic traces. Well, it depends on how you define transpersonal, Miriam. Sometimes transpersonal, I think you're talking about individuated transpersonal karmic traces, which are transpersonal karmic traces coming from within you, that would be a dream of clarity or a clear light dream. If you're talking about transpersonal, and this is a multivalent term, is that which is beyond your persona, not just within you, but actually beyond your mind stream altogether, your mental event horizon. In other words, mind at large out there. If you're talking about those kind of transpersonal karmic traces, that's a whole different deal. Because first of all, at that point, it's no longer your karmic trace. It's collective karma. So I don't think you're talking about that. I think you're talking about individuated, personal, transpersonal karmic traces. And those are very much connected with the two types of dreams that you mentioned, dreams of clarity. Those come from those, transpersonal. And then the dreams of clear light also come from those. Okay. And if you want clarity on any of these, don't be shy to come on. We can do a little back and forth. Okay. Oh, another easy one from Gerald. I love it. Dr. H, will you be offering a week-long graceful exit entry death-dying series at Drala Mountain Center in August? Yes, it should be up there. If it isn't, we have to let them know. This one's on the Luminous Bardo of Dharmata, part two. You can come as a standalone. You don't have to have the prerequisites, but it does help. So yes, Gerald, what are the dates? I can give you those dates. It should be on their website. We just put that up. I sent them the stuff like last week. August 18th to the 25th. Be there or be very square. I do an annual week-long thing there every year. I just love it. Okay, from Tsumoe. Okay, number one, two, three questions here. Concern regarding dream states. And the idea of the bardo states, between states. Okay. Bob Thurman spoke about how there are entities that experienced meditators sometimes have feed on them. Okay, if I understand that properly, Bob is talking about how it is that external, seemingly malevolent agencies can be parasitical towards you. Okay. And then the shaman, right? Alberto Viodo, I never know if I pronounce his name properly, described a baby that had these things tormenting it. Okay, how would he know that? I'm not questioning it, but it's like, is he reading this baby's mind? I mean, did the baby communicate this? So, and again, open question, I don't know. He called in the animal spirits to help the baby. Okay, cool. My concern that it is that in different states, how do I deal with things that I am not aware of? Usually I am exhausted and don't remember much. Okay. Well, if I understand this properly, this seems to be a question about seemingly malevolent entities, agencies, and so-called forces affecting you and influencing you. How do you deal with that? Well, it depends on your relationship to these things. I talk a little bit about this in my interview with Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche. So listen to that podcast on Nightclub and Edge of Mind. I actually pressed him on this. I came back two or three times to say, can you answer these sorts of things? So it really depends on who you are and what you believe. My teacher, Kenpo Rinpoche, let me just say this. My teacher, Kenpo Rinpoche, says that if you don't really believe in these things, they don't have that much impact on you. That's one version. I heard Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche say something a little bit different, that even if you don't believe in them, they can't affect you. So I let you decide which one is right. However, what you can do here is you can create protection circles for sure. Depending on what tradition you're in, the shamans, I guess Alberto was using some kind of animal spirits to help the baby. That's really, really awesome. The Buddhist tradition has protector principle. You can create a mandala. Again, it depends on who you are and what your background is. So I don't know what your tradition is. If you have a relationship to higher forces, benevolent forces in your tradition, you can call upon them, like spirit guides and angels and that sort of thing. You can call on them to protect you as you sleep and dream. If you are connected with Tibetan Buddhism, you can invoke literally a protection circle, a protection mandala. You can do liturgical recitations for protectors. I generally don't do these in a public setting because not everybody that comes to my gig is Buddhist, let alone Tibetan Buddhist. And it seems a little bit to me like I'm jamming something down their throat that may not speak to them. I am a student of these traditions. I have experienced these positive and sometimes negative agents. So I do believe in them because I've seen them. And so therefore I invoke the protection properties that I have at my disposal through my tradition. So how do you deal with them? It depends on you and it depends on your tradition. Without having some back and forth, I'm not going to kind of suggest or impose the things that I do. They work for me. They may not work for you. Here's one thing to really keep in mind, however, and this is the ultimate protection. This is really important. Everything I just said, these are relative means. I'm not dismissing them. But what is the ultimate protection, as they say in the Lojong mind training slogans? Emptiness, shunyata, emptiness. Nothing has the power to adversely affect you unless you reify that entity. Emptiness cannot harm emptiness. So this may not mean anything to you, but if you are a Buddhist and you want the ultimate protection, work with the principles of de-reification with emptiness. Nothing can affect you then, literally. Nothing has the power to adversely affect you unless you reify it. That's the ultimate protection. Number two, second question from her. I wake up in the middle of the night into a physical reality. Okay, let me stop you right there. I understand what you're saying, but it's not a physical reality. You wake up from the dream into this reality. This, parenthetically, this is not your question, but I can never pass up an opportunity to challenge this. There is no physical reality. There just isn't. Physical reality is just, I love the way Bernardo talks about this. Physical reality is just the dashboard on the panel of your perception. There is no physical reality. Physical reality is an imputation. Physicality is an inference. There is no physical reality. It's all a dream. But I get what you're saying. You wake up in the middle of the night, out of your dream, into what you think is physical reality. Okay, I do that a great deal and I paint. Oh, that's awesome. Cool. Good for you. This seems to be more like a statement than a question, which is great. I rarely remember my dreams. Well, you can change that. It's actually with some cultivation, with the aspiration to recall dreams, you can absolutely positively increase your capacity to remember dreams. So just because you don't remember them now, you are having these dreams, 5 dream cycles, 4 to 5 a night, whether you know it or not, and you can absolutely positively increase your capacity to remember. So that's more a statement than a question, I guess. Number 3, sometimes what's happening in a dream spills over into the physical space. Of course it does, because it's not physical. That's why it's spilling over, right? It's just one manifestation of mind in the dream iteration, basically then extending into the waking iteration. This happens all the time. I have had countless dreams where I wake up in the middle of the night, particular dream pattern is taking place. I wake up and then it's this bizarre as can be, then the exact same sort of thing is actually happening. Like, it's just out there kind of stuff. So the fact that this spills over into physical space, this is no surprise whatsoever. It has to do with the porosity and the permeability of your mind and the bleed through that takes place when the boundaries between these seemingly disparate states of consciousness are dissolved. They're all arbitrary boundaries. There are no fundamental boundaries. These are all creations. These boundaries are creations of our limitations to experience all these states with full lucidity. So what you're talking about here, the dream spills, that's a nice phrase, is completely common with these sorts of things. Again, it's not spilling over into physical space. It's just spilling over into another space, a mind space, another state of consciousness. What is going on? That's what's going on. This stuff happens all the time because it's just mind. Your mind consciousness basically, you can't even say traversing because that seems to imply that there's a person traversing through these states of consciousness. There isn't. There's just this mind that colors itself in the waking, dreaming, and deep dreamless state. And so if you understand that principle, there is no one going through the sleeping, dreaming, waking journey. That implies that there is an entity doing it. There isn't. There is the appearance of that, but that's not what's happening. There's just mind basically opening and contracting, creating these different dimensions of consciousness. Okay? Hope that helps. All righty. Okay, so here's a couple of, these are all quite good. Here's one, Kim. Hi, Andrew. What is that queasy, striving feeling that saturates dreams? I'm not sure, but I have an idea based on the rest of your question. These types of questions, Kim, are a little bit difficult for me to answer with any authority, because I'm not entering your mind space. I don't know what that queasy, strivey feeling is that saturates your dreams. But let me read the rest of your question, and then I do have an idea what might be going on based on your experience. It's not specific imagery, objects, or phenomena, i.e. a nightmare, just an existential dread that underlies the dream narrative. That's the key statement to me. More on that in a second. This dream nausea dread, that's an interesting term. This dream nausea, I like that, seems to be more explicit now that I am using induction techniques, and I almost feel like I can engage with it more directly, not lucid yet, but more able to identify this unseen, yucky feeling, okay? And this is where I think I can answer your question. Your last line really helps me. I've been practicing Vajrayana, studying the Bardo teachings for many years, and just started a dream yoga practice. That's what helps me here. Based on your experience, Kim, I think, again, I'll read a little supporting quote that could explain what's going on here. My guess, and again, so hard for me to say with any authority, right? I mean, what do I know? But to me, it sounds like what you're experiencing is the nausea, the dread, I believe, is an experience of an incipient taste of emptiness. In other words, what I playfully call nausea, not again, I love words, I love to play with them, not motion sickness, but notion sickness. Notion sickness, the notion that you don't exist. And so when you're in, as a practitioner, and this is why I think this could be what's happening, when you're in the dream arena, this is a more de-reified environment. The avatar, the dream avatar, doesn't have nearly the reified status that it does in the waking state. And so you're basically coming apart. I think that's what's creating this notion sickness, this nausea. This like, hey, man, I don't exist here, right? And so let me see if I can pull this up. This quote, hold on. Pull this up on my phone. This is interesting timing because this quote came in. Yeah, here it is. I went over your question last night. And the minute I got off your question, the nightclub, we have this, what is it called? Whispers of Wisdom that comes up every day. And the synchronicity was kind of cool. So this is exactly what I read in my inbox because I get these whispers every day as well. Even though I write them, I forget them. And this is what it says. And it's like, this is it. This is so from Steve Hodge. This is his introduction and commentary, I think, to his translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead or his version of it. This is good. Our so-called self, the ego, is a parasitical illusion without any substantial existence. Something that has been constructed as a defense mechanism to deal with the experience of impermanence. As it strives to create itself out of empty space and become solid, the ego self always feels paranoid that it will be discovered for what it is, a hollow illusion. Ah, talk about synchronicity. I mean, that's amazing. There's your answer, right? That's it. So if you get the nightclub quotes, the quote from yesterday answers your question. Basically, you're discovering the parasitical illusion of the self-sense, that it's just this, there's nothing there. And that's what gives you the queasy feeling. Otherwise, the experience would be just what it is, experience of dissolution. So I think next time you have this experience, Kim, what you can try to do, this is how do I work with this? Here's what I recommend. When you experience your dreams without reference, you're a Buddhist practitioner, Tolopa's beautiful statement, when the mind is free of reference point, this is Mahamudra, the nature of mind. When one has become accustomed to this, familiar with it, enlightenment, the unsurpassable, has been achieved. So basically, when you have the experience next time, don't reference it. Don't contract. Because the nausea, I guarantee you this, the nausea is created, the dread is created by reference to self. That's what creates the dread. If you just have the experience without the reference, there's no dread. There's just the experience. I promise you that. So that's the way I would work with this yucky feeling. The yucky feeling is only yucky from the point of ego, because ego is basically starting to attend its own funeral, so to speak, which it can't do. And that creates this kind of yucky feeling because it's dying. It's being seen through it. It can't die because it doesn't exist. It's simply being dissolved and seen through. So I think that's what's going on. That makes sense to me. Okay. Oh, this one's a little bit longer. And this one's a little bit intense, a little bit beautiful. And I'll keep it anonymous just in case you want me to. This one's powerful. So I'm currently in the midst of what feels like a ripe period with opportunity for transformation. I'm seeking guidance. My two greatest fears since childhood have been death and childbirth. Over a period of years, I worked with my fear of death until eventually I convinced myself that I would go gentle into that good night. That's a beautiful reference to Dylan Thomas's famous poem, Rage, Rage Against the Dying of the Light, right? Do not go gentle into that good night. Dylan Thomas is totally wrong. Back to you. Last year, after realizing I could not avoid facing my other fear, great fear any longer, I became pregnant. Since the last trimester of my pregnancy, I have been waking in the night with a strong sense of existential anxiety. When this happens, I feel panicked and unable to tolerate the darkness of the room. It is now clear that my fear of death never left, but went underground. Yeah, that's usually what happens. So good insight for you. It basically just gets buried. Out of sight is not out of mind. Out of sight is deep into the unconscious mind. It's going to percolate there until, related to the question above, you transcend the very sense of self that creates a sense of fear to begin with. So good for you for seeing that. You can't solve a problem you don't know you have. And you're not alone. Everybody has this dread until they wake up. I recently gave birth to my daughter after a difficult labor that ended in a C-section for me in ICU. For me, while recovering in the hospital, I was diagnosed with pulmonary embolism. Yeah, that's non-trivial. Big deal. The very thing that killed my paternal grandmother. Not long after returning home, I was readmitted to the hospital when a new PE was found, pulmonary embolism, in spite of my being on a heavy dose of anticoagulants. While in the hospital, I experienced frequent hypnic jerks, myoclonic jerks, fearing I would die if I were to fall asleep. Let me just say a couple of things as I go along, because otherwise this is somewhat long and I'll lose a track and have to repeat it. So in relation to this, the hypnic jerks, what are also called myoclonic jerks, are extraordinarily common when you're going through the hypnagogic liminal phase, going from waking to dream and sleep. You're literally falling apart. You're coming undone. And so very often when people have these hypnic jerks, we've all had them, part of it is exactly what you're saying, feeling that you would die if you were to fall asleep. Well, on one level, you do die. Your ego dies, for sure. And that ultimate death, the provisional death, entry-level death, takes place in the dream, kind of also connected to the earlier question. The full death, egolessness, takes place in deep dreamless sleep, which is why we don't experience it. It's too scary, right? It's too scary for the ego to experience deep dreamless sleep. So it doesn't experience it. It blacks out. It's still there. Phenomenal consciousness is still there, but metacognition of that is not. So what you're saying here is really common. And the good news here for both of these is it denotes a really sensitive mind, a really sensitive experiencer, someone who can now see the fear that's still there. Not easy, but really good. Now you can work with it. Someone who recognizes this fear of falling asleep and dying, that's also really good, because you know, you're being aware of what's actually taking place. When you fall asleep, you're actually falling into a microcosmic death. You are. And sometimes the panic that ensues, you know, you feel that dissolution, you're falling, literally, bindus are falling, you're falling apart. And what happens is, what's the jerk? It's a contraction. It's panic, it's contraction. What does that contraction do? Contraction is ego's affective response, fear, to its dissolution. So that's what creates the contraction, the fear, is you're falling apart and your contraction actually reinstates the very sense of self that's dissolving. That's why you contract. That's why you have the hypnic jerk. And fundamentally, whether we know it or not, in this playful sense, we're all jerks. We all live above this vibration, this frequency of this contraction. You're just simply now starting to see it. This contraction is happening all the time. I'm writing two books on it. It's such a big deal topic. This contraction is happening all the time, even now as we speak. If you see yourself as existing, if you see me separate from you, you're contracting. So what you're experiencing here is totally connected to this. And honestly, this is good news. You're starting to see really, you know, it's not easy. It's not comfortable from, again, the perspective of ego. It's only ego that creates the fear. It's only ego that creates this sense of unease. Be with the experience, relax into it. There's part of you that can't die, man. There's a part of you that is indestructible, that cannot die. That's what you want to discover. So then when you go through these phases, it's like, hey, man, this is like no big deal. Then it becomes really interesting. It's like, whoa, here I am falling apart again. How cool. Here I am coming back into form again in the morning. How cool, if I can do it lucidly, right? So I guess what I'm saying here, obstacle into opportunity. The fear is a good sign. Having this experience is a good sign if you relate to it properly. And maybe that's what I'm helping you with here. Okay, back to you. Well, the past 6 weeks have shown me are the persistence of my fear of death. Yes, everybody, if they don't have that, they are denying it until they're awake. And my strong attachment to my baby. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. This is where it really gets tender and difficult for me to say much about, but I'll try. My love for her is a source of not only incredible joy, but also incredible sorrow, because I know one day it will come to an end. Picturing dying now, I think I would go kicking and screaming. Well, again, thank you for being so honest. Anybody would in that situation. So this is really tricky, right? Because first of all, I'm not a therapist. You're talking about really beautiful, profound things. And here I am in a public setting throwing out sound bites for something that's really quite deep and profound. So please accept my apology in advance. This is something that would warrant a really much more in-depth conversation and dialogue instead of me just trying to spit out some stuff. But with the understanding the parameters, the limitations, I can say a couple things here maybe. Attachment, we are attached to everything. It just becomes more painful, exquisitely painful when it comes to family members and the intimates around us. And I'm only going to tell you what my teachers have told me, because I don't want to be glib, facile, and dismissive of the elegance, the beauty, the sensitivity, the profundity of what you're sharing and you're experiencing. My teacher, Kenpo Rinpoche, would always tell us about the charter of love without attachment. Love without attachment. That's unconditional love. And for most people, it's like that. That's like an oxymoron. I don't even know what that means. Maybe we can simply use that as an aspiration. The fact that, again, this is so beautiful about what you're saying. I'm trying to see all the wonderful lights in what you're saying. The fact that you can actually discern this is really beautiful. And the attachment is, I mean, we're attached to everything. That's why it hurts when something is taken away from us. That's why it hurts when someone dies. I mean, really, it again, nobody's died yet here, so I can say this. It may seem like cold and clinical and whatnot, but see if it's true. Kick the tires, see if it's true. Grief is a form of withdrawal. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't grieve. No, it's a completely appropriate response. But grief is a form of withdrawal of our attachment, almost our addiction to attachment. And so, you know, I'm in no position to say like what you should do here. I can only tell you that you can use these really powerful experiences to inspire profound investigations, to look properly at, or clearly at what's really important for you, to look at the power, to see if it's true, how attached we are to things. See if you can have an open heart, love without attachment. Again, easier said than done. But also noticing what you're saying here, that in one level, this is a very powerful expression of the four reminders that everything is impermanent. This is a noble truth. Everything that comes into form will disappear. That includes us. That includes your baby. That includes everything. Now, that doesn't mean we have to then live in this kind of pathological paranoia. No. What it means is we can therefore use this impermanence to actually reframe our relationship with others and energize it. If you hold everything in the embrace of impermanence and death, it ironically and beautifully makes things more valuable, more precious, more purposeful. It's only when we take things for granted, oh, they're going to be around forever, whatever, that we live a kind of pilot light level existence. And so this is what you say here: my love for her is a source of not only incredible joy, but incredible sorrow. Well, Trungpa Rinpoche said very beautifully, the ideal, this is such a beautiful cryptic statement, but he was a genius, this guy. I mean, even genius is a pejorative for him. He said the ideal emotion is sad joy. I mean, what an amazing thing to say. The ideal emotion is sad joy. Sad, the root, means satisfied, fullness. It's like the sad joy you feel with incredibly beautiful music or art or poetry. You feel like laughing and crying sad joy at the same time. So what you're sharing here is really the ideal emotion, this ability to like hold these two spaces in your own heart and mind. And again, if you hold her with the embrace, it's like, this is a wonderful line. Let me just do this demo. Ajahn Chah, I think it was. So he holds up this glass. I wasn't there, but I read it. He's holding up this glass in a teaching. And he does kind of the following riff. He says, look at this glass. He goes, this glass is amazing. It holds water. When I ping it, it sings. There's all these amazing things. But one day I'm going to knock it off the shelf and it's going to break. And then he goes into this beautiful riff about how my understanding of the impermanence of this glass makes me appreciate the glass all the more. And so I write about this quite a bit in the first part of my book, Preparing to Die, using the kind of the mechanism or the medium or the four reminders, contemplating the fragility, the impermanence of life, not in a pathological way, but actually as a way to saturate and imbue our life with increased sensitivity, joy, and appreciation. So look at the positives here. It will make you appreciate your daughter more. It will make you appreciate others more. But then the trick is, and again, the stickiness. Notice how often we get sticky, we grasp. And the minute we grasp, and if we reify that grasping, that's attachment. Grasping is active, attachment is passive. Attachment is reified grasping. So again, I don't want to get too clinical. This is a really delicate thing. I'm doing my best with a really rich question instead of comments. I hope this is helpful. What simple practices can I do on a daily ongoing basis alongside the demands of a new baby to ease my fear of death and to learn to love my daughter with less clinging? I mean, this is so beautiful. Well, in addition to what I said, maybe consider doing the four reminders on a regular basis. Those are really, really helpful. To ease your fear of death for you, this is a really beautiful big question. This is what the entire corpus of Bardo teachings are all about. You know, to discover, this is the summit statement, to discover that which cannot die because it was never born. Let me say that again. To discover that which cannot die because it was never born. So the way to work with the fear of death is use your fear of death to propel you to the truth. I mean, Milarepa, right? In horror of death, this amazing man who killed 37 people, and he realized the deep trouble he was in. He said, in horror of death, I took to the mountains. Contemplating again and again on the uncertainty and the hour of death, I captured the fortress of the deathless, unending nature of mind. Thus, all fear of death is over and done with. Wholesome fear. Use your fear to propel you to the truth. And therefore, if you can discover literally that you're not this outer body, you're temporarily wearing this costume, your baby is temporarily wearing that particular costume, that costume will be dropped at the end of life. There are deeper dimensions of your being that are naked in a certain sense. They actually talk about naked awareness that don't enter the world of space and time. This is the part of you that won't die. This is the inner part of your baby that will not die. And so this is where deep spiritual practice will take you. And it leaves you with this indestructible joy of the appreciation of life and also tremendous ease and confidence, right? So this is basically, your question is all about, why should I study the Bardo literature? Why should I study Bardo teachings? Because of questions like this. Beautiful, deep stuff. I hope what I shared is of some benefit. Not easy to shrink wrap these things. Okay, so a couple more and then we'll open it up for people here. Okay, yeah, so this is a good one, Matt. I'll see if I can find the quote to support this. In terms of phenomenology, which is basically study of experience, are there any explanations for the difference between the dream state and the waking state? There's a lot of questions here, so I'll answer them as I go along. Yes, there's a ton. In fact, this is why I wrote this entire book right here. The second book in my dream trilogy, which we have on the nightclub site. We spent, I don't know, 100 hours going through this book line by line. This entire book was written to answer this question. And so if I can find it, I will find you several supporting quotes that really riff on this. Are there any explanations? Yes, there's a ton of explanations. I'll see if I can pull up a couple quotes. Why is the dreaming state private and intermittent while the waking state seems to be shared with others and consistent? Well, the dreaming state is private and intermittent only because we exclusively identify with the waking state and we tend to dismiss the dream state. So this kind of wake centricity, the supremacy, ontological supremacy that takes place in the waking state, that therefore then imbues, projects onto the dreaming state, this kind of private intermittent quality. It's intermittent because the mind hasn't become stable enough to see, like I mentioned earlier, that when the mind is completely awake, and I'm not being metaphorical here, this is literal. There's no difference in the mind of an awakened one between being awake, asleep, dreaming. No difference. In fact, let me see if I can remember this quote. This is from Ramana Maharshi from Advaita Vedanta tradition. The sage dreams, but he knows it to be a dream, the same way he knows the waking state to be a dream. Established in the state of supreme reality, the sage detachedly witnesses the other three states, waking, dreaming, and dreamless sleep, as pictures superimposed onto it. For the sage, all three states are equally unreal. Most people are unable to comprehend this, because for them, the standard of reality is the waking state. Whereas for the sage, the standard is reality itself. What an amazing statement. That's it from the perspective of Advaita Vedanta. When you're established in the state of supreme reality, in Buddhist language, Rigpa, Dharmakaya, Dharmadhatu, clear light mind, from that perspective, just like Ramana Maharshi is saying, from that perspective, all other states are seen just as that. They're states that come and go, no more real or unreal than any other. And that's the journey of awakening, to differentiate from, die to, let go of identification with any of those states. Because if it's a state, by definition, it's impermanent. It's not who you are. It's not going to last. You want to drop below that into this fundamental state from which everything appears to be a dream or manifestation of mind. These two aspects of the waking state, which differentiate it from the dreaming state. Oh, wait. While the waking state seems to be shared with others and is consistent. Well, again, it seems to be that way. This waking state isn't consistent. That's why I wrote this bloody book, especially part three on the science. This waking state is reified and frozen. It's an imputation and projection. The consistency, the stability is not inherent in the fabric of reality. Reality, when it's seen properly, is pixelated, pointillistic, empty, fluid, dreamlike. Every scientist will tell you this, quantum physicist, every perceptual cognitive scientist will tell you this. It's just, everything is just fleeting, floating, dreamlike. We're the ones that freeze it into concrete and steel. So the consistency you talk about is not inherent in the reality that you're talking about. It's a projection of your internal states of consciousness. While the seeming state of others, while the waking state seems to be shared with others, there is a collective karma thing going on. There's a certain consensual reality that we share, but it's highly idiosyncratic. You think you're sharing the same thing? Well, why don't you get Rachel Maddow and Tucker Carlson together and see if they're seeing and sharing the same thing, right? Right? Same phenomenal appearance, radically different interpretation. So not only this is ontologically of issue, this is culturally of issue. This is where culture wars come about. And if you want to get even a further rendering of this, and I might have this book here because I just ripped it. Read this book. This is an unbelievable book. An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. This book will blow your mind. It's a book, a marvelous book about all the different ways that animals, our animal brothers and sisters, enact their realities. I mean, if we took a vote and took all the animal kingdoms and we had a vote, what is to reality? What is reality? We would be voted out of office. In fact, that's actually what's happening. We are being voted out. Trust me on this. We're going to be scraped off this effing planet, right? And the animals are going to survive, hopefully, if we don't bloody eliminate them. Don't get me started on this crap. But this is a beautiful book about the relativistic nature of perception and the realities that we enact. There is nothing solid, lasting, independent and out there. There is an imputation projection from our karmic histories, our biological histories, all these co-conspiratorial factors that come together to create this world of reality that we call reality. It's not a reality, it's a construct. Talk to my dog, see what he thinks. Talk to my cat. Talk to a hummingbird. Talk to a lizard. Talk to a snake. Talk to a fish. This is a profound contemplation to study the nature of our animal brothers and sisters and to see that what we call reality is just, we take in less than one, here's the math on this, man. We take in less than 1/10 trillionth of the data that's flowing in around us. Think about that. It's like ridiculous. And we think it's real? No way. So anyway, this is a really good question. Okay. Oh, these two aspects of the waking state, which differentiate it from the dreaming state, seem to be the two main obstacles to seeing waking life as dreamlike. That's a good point. I agree. Any deconstruction of these two aspects would be very helpful. Dude, that's the whole bloody path, man. That's why I wrote this stupid book. Read it. Apologies if this question has already been asked and answered before. No apology needed. But we did go through this whole book in what, like 50 sessions last time. But let me see if I can find, there's two quotes here. Let me find these for you, because I'll leave with these and we'll get the live ones, because this is a really great question. So let me see, or Gimpa, hold on. Let me see if I can find this for you. Oh, here it is, 115, 116. Yeah, check this out. This is such a great quote. Okay, two quotes. just because this stuff is so rich. So the first one is from my teacher, Kenpo Rinpoche. I'm going to read this in full because it's so rich. In response to the question whether you're dreaming or not, like right now, how do you know you're not dreaming right now? Check this out. So this is from this guy's awake, right? So this is from an awakened master. Maybe you feel like saying, because dreams are never so vivid as this. Colors are not so bright. Forms, sounds, smells, touches, and tastes are not so clear and precise. However, someone else might disagree and say his dreams are even more vivid than his daytime experiences. Anybody that's had a hyperlucid dream, you know this. You wake up from a hyperlucid dream, this seems to be the dream. Does this then make his dreams waking experience and his waking a dream? Does it mean if your faculties become impaired so that you're no longer experiencing so precisely and clearly that your life becomes a dream? You may laugh at the suggestion that you're dreaming now. You may think that if you were asleep and dreaming, everybody would stop interacting with you. They would tell you that when you woke up that you had been dreaming. So there's no way that one could confuse dreaming with waking. However, there is no inherent reason why you should not dream that people have woken you up and told you that you have just awakened from a dream. And here's the kicker. Finally, one has to admit that there is no fundamental characteristic of waking experience that clearly distinguishes it from dreaming. It's only a matter of degree and one's emotional predisposition. And I could do a whole rant here, predisposition based on fear. If this world wasn't solid underneath your feet, you would freaking freak out, right? So you freeze the world so that you feel comfortable in it. It's all psychological, man. You believe you are awake because you want to feel secure and feel that the world is solid, real, and supportive around you. If you were to seriously doubt you were awake, you would feel frightened and confused. The stability of the experience of being awake reassures you. So you believe in it and give it a reality that you do not afford to dreams. If you suffer in a dream, you're happy to let it go when it ends, feeling reassured that it was not real anyway. If you suffer in what you call your waking life, you get emotionally involved in it and afford it the status of absolute reality. I am not saying there's no difference at all between waking and dreaming. I am saying that the difference is not one of an essential difference in substance. And here's the last one. This one's even better. And then I'll open it up. This is from Mahasiddha or Gyempa. When I first read this, I was just floored. The distinction that we make between waking appearances and dream appearances is purely based upon the fact that we do not wake up from our waking experiences, at least until we practice dream yoga and illusory form. Back to him. The waking experience has been going on since a period of time that never began and is never really interrupted except by the additional overlay of dream time confusion. We know that dreams are not real because we wake up from them periodically and therefore we have contrast. This is the line. However, we have no such contrast by which to recognize the unreality of conventional appearances. Until you find a dimension of reality that is more real than this, the clear light mind. Until you discover a state of mind, a substance to stand below, substance more real than this, which we haven't discovered until we discover the clear light mind, we reify this reality. We don't see it as a dream. Back to him. All the things that we experience when we dream are obviously the appearance of habits that have somehow been placed in our minds. In turn, we understand that the reactions we have to dream images, such as pleasure and pain, and the various sensations that we have in dreams do not have the slightest true reality. Although these sensations and experiences are quite vivid, when we awake from sleep, we understand that they are not real. And here it is. The only reason that we do not have the same understanding of conventional waking appearances is that we have not woken up from them yet. I mean, hello, this is the most profound quote. This summarizes the whole bloody journey of lucid dreaming, dream yoga, and the practice of a lucid form. Okay. Wow, what a set of great questions, everybody. Now I will turn. Sorry it took long, but I don't want to rush through these. The questions are so good. I get speedy anyway. I just want to slow down. So let me see if anything else buzzed in. Otherwise, I will turn to Chelsea, Emily, and then whatever came in the chat column. Cool. Thanks for your patience. Hey, Chelsea, fire away. Nice to see you.
Hi, good to see you too. So a question, and then I also just have a comment, kind of speaking to what you were talking about, something you were talking about earlier. So my question has to do with open awareness.
Okay.
So I'm noticing the more I practice it, the more I notice myself wanting to go back into like shamatha almost.
Okay.
Like, which is this really interesting thing. And I'm wondering, do I become just more rigid where I just open, or do I let myself, because I've been playing with both, but I also know it's not a great idea to blend them necessarily.
Okay.
So what do you recommend?
Yeah. So let me ask you this, Chelsea. So what is the kind of the emotional, what are the reasons that you want to pull away from open awareness and back to shamatha? Like what's driving that impetus?
I think it might be just a pattern that's being created. Like I did it a couple times maybe, and I don't know.
What's the it?
I went like back to shamatha like a couple times, and then I think I like accidentally blended them. And now I'm trying to figure out how to disentangle them is how it feels to me.
Okay. Yeah. Really good stuff. So, you know, all the practices in Buddhism, really all of them can basically be categorized as variations of shamatha or vipassana. Shamatha, the practices of tranquility, concentration, concentrative practices. Vipassana, the practices of insight and the like. And so fundamentally, initially, when we start, we centrifuge out the practices of shamatha and vipassana. We practice shamatha first, then we practice vipassana. But the key is, and your question is a good one, because the key fundamentally is the union of shamatha and vipassana. You want to be able to unify the two practices because they're basically what? They're cultivating two aspects of the mind. It's not like they're two completely disparate faculties of the mind, right? They're just different aspects of the mind. So we start with shamatha because without that stability, it's also a little bit easier. There will be no stability if you do, you're creating an infrastructure. There's be no ground. If you don't have quality in stability in shamatha, and just read the works of B. Allen Wallace, you know, I mean, when I interviewed him 3 years ago, I mean, this guy is known as Mr. Shamatha. It's fantastic, right? People tend to race over shamatha to get to the goodies, the vipassana type practices, and then they don't stick. They're unstable. They don't work. So shamatha is super important, but shamatha in and of itself will not liberate. Shamatha sedates. It does not liberate. So then eventually you want to initially, because we don't have the capacity, we do practice these separately, whether it's conventional vipassana or an open awareness, you know, what's called a mahavipassana. You're working it's the highest level of vipassana before you get to nature of mind, mahamudra vipassana. And so originally we do it separately because we just don't have that facility and ability, but eventually they start to merge and you can have, it's a little bit like, if you've ever had this experience of like, if you had to hold a teaspoonful of water, you know, you're holding a teaspoon, you have a fill of water and you have to walk across a room, right? That's the union of shamatha and vipassana. Paying attention to the teaspoon, not spilling it is shamatha. Having the panoramic awareness that allows you to walk through the room is vipassana. You want to work with both. So I would just say, just hang with it. The fact that you notice that propensity is interesting. Play with it. Don't beat yourself up. Sometimes the reason I asked you what is the reason you do that, some people come back to shamatha because they find vipassana too open. There's no place for personal identity in that space. You're actually fundamentally, whether you know it or not, open awareness will take you apart. Shamatha will not. And so sometimes people retreat from open awareness because it's too open. It's just too much because it's too little. And so then they retract back into shamatha and they go, oh, this is great. I feel comfortable. This is cool. I'm safe. I'm grounded. You know, if you want to chill out and the world's on fire, that's great. But this is why I'm writing this other book, Okay, I'm Mindful, Ma What, right? Endorsement and critique of the mindfulness revolution. Mindfulness sedates, it does not liberate. So I would say just be aware of what you're doing, play with it. Don't be too hard on yourself. Maybe work, you know, just continue to stretch your mind from the comfort zone of shamatha into vipassana. Notice what it does without judgment. And then just be playful and just persistent and consistent. And then you will notice eventually, because these are fundamentally inseparable qualities of the mind, you will notice that they will start to emerge, right? Something like that.
Yeah, what you said about the teaspoon was really helpful, because it does kind of feel like that. And because I was noticing it happening, I was becoming overly aware of it almost, of like, oh, I'm going back to shamatha. I don't think I'm supposed to do that. But hearing that it eventually gets to a place where it reintegrates back together and it kind of dances.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's helpful. Thank you.
They're all manifestations of mind, certain aspects that are being exercised separately, and then eventually they're brought into union. And here's the other kicker, and then we'll let it go. Yes, on one level, you're cultivating them here, but on another level, you're discovering them. These are inherent properties of the mind. So carry on. Okay, nice to see you, Chelsea.
You need to discover. Can I also just share a comment as well?
Yeah, totally. Fire away.
So the comment just as quick. So something that I've been practicing is just opening my heart, compassion, and doing that in dreams, in lucid dreams. Okay. And so what you were speaking to about the dream world kind of filtering into the waking world, I've been experiencing that at night, because I've had different things keeping me up at night, whether it be people or construction or something. Last night it was construction. And it was almost like I became lucid I was in my room. It felt a little bit like a false awakening. Then I recognized I was dreaming. And then I went outside to the construction that was happening and to the construction workers. And I was just like, thank you. Thank you.
Awesome.
In my dream. So
that's
having
really cool.
that kind of that thin veil.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's something I've noticed more and more as I practice.
The veils of perception, the boundaries start to drop, right? Read Ken Wilber's second great book, No Boundary. The veils eventually start to break down. And then fundamentally, you'll discover the veils between the unconscious and the conscious mind start to break down. There is, you know, there fundamentally is no unconscious mind. That's basically a facade. So all these veils get thinner. You start to see through yourself. You start to see through others. You start, you know, all the boundaries break down. So the fact that you're actually starting to see that is a really beautiful sign. Something's happening. Cool. Thanks, dear. Hey, Emily, how are you?
Good. Also had more of a technical question about meditation. So in Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche's book, he encourages you to meditate on an object and on the Tibetan A. And so I got this pillow that has the letter on it.
Yep.
Trying to concentrate on it. And he says it's hard. You have, you know, it takes a long time to work up to just staring at an object for, you know, a long time. So I'm, you know, but I'm working with it. And I'm just wondering what you think about this concentration practice, and do you recommend it? And is it something that'll help me with lucid dreaming?
Yes. Yeah. Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche is big on that. And it's wonderful. It definitely has a place, Emily. Again, every one of these practices, this is what's so great. Every one of these practices are skillful means designed to work with a particular bandwidth of our mind and heart. They all have a very powerful place, but they all are limited. No one practice alone will really do it. So therefore, the strength of the concentrative shamatha, this is shamatha with form, referential shamatha you're talking about, it's a wonderful way to tether, anchor, and tame the mind that eventually will be trained through shamatha. But again, as powerful as that practice is, I'm not dissing it at all. It is limited. It only takes you so far. But I think for many of us, and again, this is where I do agree with Alan Wallace, for many of us in the West, we get, it sometimes, especially the tantrikas, the Vajrayana people, they tend to hopscotch over the shamatha practices. And then they wonder why they don't have any stability. Then they wonder why their higher level practices aren't working. They just get too impatient and they want to rush to their esoteric, sexy types of practices, and they just don't work. So I really appreciate the kind of infrastructure things that Tenzin Rinpoche does and others. It absolutely positively has a place, but always remember that those types of concentrative practices, they only go so far. And then eventually you do have to mature. Some teachers will say that if you do shamatha purely, it will naturally, spontaneously morph into vipassana. I think theoretically that could be. I haven't seen that in my experience as a meditation instructor. People can just get stuck in these jhana states and these God realms. And they're really delicious. These samadhi states are really juicy. They're really sexy meditation states of mind. But this is what the Buddha exhausted when he studied with all the Brahmin Hindu teachings of his era. He mastered all the absorption states. And then he realized close but no cigar. So this is a massive, you go through the 9 stages of shamatha. And this is a massive teaching that you should read. There's a number of books on this topic. I think Alan Wallace's The Intention Revolution, I think. He goes through the 9 stages, turning your mind into an ally is another book. It's helpful to understand the 9 stages of shamatha. It's really helpful to bring a level of articulation to the otherwise woolly nature of our mind. But always realize that these are the best thing. They'll give you the very best of samsara. These states will bring you into the God realms. They'll bring you into the jhana states, the absorption states. And then you'll be reborn as a god. But that's the penthouse in samsara, man. It's not nirvana. It's not a pure land. It's a high God realm. And this is a very interesting kind of conversation / debate with the Theravadan tradition, which I'm always happy to engage in. So again, these practices are beautiful, they're genius, they have their place, but in the integral spirit, it's not enough. Critical, right? Necessary, but not sufficient. And use it in that regard. Train your mind. Again, if you're involved with Tenzin Rinpoche, this guy's a rock star. So if you're doing his stuff, man, just do it. Do what he says. Because then he will, through a conveyor belt approach, he will invite you into these other so-called higher practices, which transcend but include shamatha. Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, Kathy, wake up.
Oh, no, I'm kind of meditating on it.
Oh, no, like, I'm really I'm paying attention.
I wanted to ask you, what's the difference between out of body astral projection and dream body, lucid dreaming?
Yeah, that question came in somewhere. It wasn't on this list. It's a good question. So it depends on how you define these terms. These are really good questions. There's when people talk about astral body, subtle body, dream body, its relationship. If you're Buddhist to Sambhogakaya, one has to be really careful and really precise about what exactly are you referring to and what are you talking about? Because these are all phenomenal bodies within the bandwidth of what in Shambhala is called the inner court. Within Tibetan Buddhism, it's called the Sambhogakaya, which is this vast intermediate display of subtle body. So basically what you're talking about here, all the variations of the subtle body, there isn't just one subtle body. There's a whole bandwidth of these subtle bodies. And so the Buddhist tradition doesn't really talk, it doesn't use things like astral body, astral projection. That's not its nomenclature. But I think if you were really to sit down, be very specific, and this is what I love about translators, they're so careful with these things, you could definitely start to see these overlaps. So let me pause for a second. Maybe you can rephrase your question or even just ask it again, because this is such a big topic. I want to make sure I'm hitting your sweet spot.
Well, I don't actually feel like I have astral projection experience, but I've been really interested and I'm taking lesson from people that I really do believe they have the experience. And so it would be like, they literally, there's like an astral body, they call it astral body, whatever you want to call it, that leaves the physical body and it does its thing in the astral reality. And obviously there's a difference in time perception. So I was asking this man, I'm like, well, do you think it's different from dream body, dream? And he thinks it is, but we didn't get
there's
into
ways to,
it.
There's ways so, to test that. There's ways to test that. Let me refer you to a couple of very elegant, sophisticated sources here. The best one, I think, is Evan Thompson's masterpiece of a book, Waking Dreaming Being. Read this book, Self and Consciousness and Neuroscience, Meditation and Philosophy. This is an incredible book. And in this book, Evan devotes at least one chapter to the whole out of body thing. And in a really elegant, sophisticated way, which makes so much sense to me because he's so smart, most out of body experiences are actually altered embodied experiences. And so it's basically, it's an issue of altered embodiment. You can induce out of body experiences using haptic VRI. There's all kinds of ways you can do this without even entering into the dream state. There's also a way to test whether you're having a true astral OBE or a hyperlucid dream. Most of these experiences, when I sit down and I talk to people, and again, I can't say with total authority, I can only tell you my experience. When I'm talking to people about this, I ask them 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 questions. I can usually tell, not in any critical way, that's not an OBE, that's a hyperlucid dream. And there's several ways you can test. Here's just two things, just two of many. One is when you're in that experience, let's say you're having this experience, one thing you can do is spin your avatar, spin your dream body, spin your astral body, whatever it is, spin it. And then stop. When you stop spinning, is it a different scene or is it the same scene? If it's a different scene, that's a hyperlucid dream. If it's the same scene, that's probably an out-of-body experience. That's just one test. So there are actually ways where you can test this phenomenologically for yourself. And so I have an open mind around these things, but I'm also, you know, agnostic and a little bit skeptical. Because again, I've talked to dozens, if not hundreds of people who have these OBEs, and time after time, it's a hyperlucid dream. I'm not criticizing it. It's a great experience, but it's not an OBE. And so again, I put my scientific hat on here a little bit and say, if this is really true, why can't they do these in laboratory situations? Why can't they do these remote viewing things, which sometimes they can? But for purposes of time, I would recommend highly, highly read Ivan Thompson's beautiful book, Waking Dreaming Being. And then also on the wonderful anthology edited by Stephen LaBerge and Jane Kalkenbach, I think it's called Sleeping Brain, Waking Mind or something like that. There's a brilliant chapter in that book by Susan Blackburn. She's a psychologist, parapsychologist. And her riff on this is also really brilliant. So if you're really into the stuff and you're playing with it, and again, there is, again, in classic dream yoga, stage seven dream yoga is in fact to create a special dream body and do these sorts of things. But what's actually taking place, ontologically, phenomenologically, this is a really deep question that requires, I think, really subtle investigation, a little bit outside of our scope for today. But maybe some of those comments will help you, at least send you in a direction where you can do some homework.
Thank you, Andrew.
I love it. Good stuff. Okay, two more, and then we probably got to close it. Hey, Jimbe, unmute yourself, bro. Mute.
There you go. Can you hear me now? Sorry.
You're good.
Thank you, Andrew. Yeah, my question was about sound. I'm recalling a lucid dream that I had that was induced by sort of the transition from hypnagogic state into right into the dream, but it started with like a very low hum that was almost like an ohm or an ohm. And then as I fell into it, it became very loud, like a channel that I kind of drifted into. And I hadn't thought about it in a long time, but I was at a sound meditation where, the musicologist was speaking about sound waves. And the short of it is, are there channels that can be like rediscovered somehow where, one might find the space and drop into it, or that you know of, or is it just that happened to be that experience?
You mean with replicability, right? Something that you could kind of tune into that could invite you into the state of consciousness. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, exactly. At the time, I had been doing a lot of meditations. I was really kind of aware of, maybe more sound rather than, astral sound, maybe. I don't know how to describe it, but it really became almost as if it was a sound that was, it had its channel of the ohm or the ohm channel.
Oh, man, I'm hearing so many different things here, bro. So I'm not entirely sure what you're saying. I mean, my mind is going all over the place because...
I'm sorry. Okay, well, I guess the short question might be is, if I'm investigating sounds, and specifically, you know, sounds that are being created, some which are healing sounds or sacred sounds,
yep.
Is there a way of dropping into, are there channels that one might be able to drop into and follow it into this, you know?
So channels of sound or channels of consciousness or both?
Yeah, channels of sound that lead in, that are at the same time channels of consciousness that one might, you know, have this experience of a non-body lucid, you know.
Well, I think it's possible. I mean, like, why not, right? So, for instance, here, I mean, the reason I'm interested in this right now is I just met a guy, I'm going to meet with him in a couple of weeks, who has this whole, it actually sounds really pretty effing amazing. So stay tuned, I'll get back to you. This whole amazing sound and light binaural, it's not even binaural beat, it transcends it, using lights and sounds and all kinds of things to induce particular states of consciousness. So I'm going to go down to his little lab central place and play with the stuff. When I come back, I think I'm doing that at the end of March, I'll file a report and let you know where it took me, right? But, you know, and also you might want to listen to the interview I just did with John Dupuy, because he gave a free link at the bottom to his iAwake technology, which is brain, WEE, brain wave entrainment things. Check that out. Theoretically, what you're saying, oh yeah, for sure, right? Each one of these sounds has the capacity, and this is actually really interesting stuff. Every state of consciousness is associated with a chakra, with an energetic system, with a sound, and with a color. And so theoretically, and not even theoretically, if you're really good at it, maybe this is what happened to you spontaneously, through the recitation of the sound, for instance, in this case, the sound associated with the sleeping consciousness, Samboga, Samboga Kaya, Samboga Chakra, is Om Hum. And so by reciting these sounds, conjoining them, especially with visualizations, inner yogas are actually precisely about this, where you can then, through the process of visualization and sound, invite what are called the bindus, the mind pearls, drops, to move into these respective centers. And the correlative phenomenal experience is waking, dreaming, and sleeping. So to me, it makes total sense that either serendipitously or perhaps with some induction techniques that really rock, you could have these color sounds and whatnot that could, in fact, channel you into these states of consciousness. I see no reason why you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense to me. But get back to me in a month, right? And I'm really interested in checking out the scene. And if it works, I'll ping it all over the place and I'll say, go see Sweet Michael, check out his gig. He's a very smart guy, and I'm actually really excited about what he's got to share. So stay tuned. I'll get back to you at the end of the month on that one. Okay. Hey, here's the way I roll with this stuff, man. If it works, these are the principles of neurophenomenology, right? With every phenomenological experience, state of mind, there is a neurological correlate. That's just the way it works. Correlation, not causation. So if you work with the neurological correlates, it makes total sense that you could invite the phenomenological experiences. It makes total sense to me. And so I'm sure if the Buddha was alive today and he had access to these things to alter consciousness, I think he would be all over these things. Like, these are skillful means. Why not use these devices to bring about so-called altered states of consciousness? They're just different states, to allow one to discover the fluidity of the mind and all the other things that can happen. But basically what you say really does make sense to me. And I think absolutely positively you can do this sort of thing. Okay. Awesome. Okay. One last one from Adam, and then I'll go through the chat column and then we're done.
Fire away. Thank you very much. Okay. My first time on the channel. Just a very methodological question. Okay. So I read your books. I started about 3 years ago. I have very good with the hypnagogic state, very good with dream recall. Oh. I've had just a few lucid dreams, but I really have a lot of trouble. Like, you know, I'm spending a lot of time working on it, and I just am having a hard time with actually achieving lucidity. It's like, you know, I'll be dropping into the hypnagogic state at 4 a.m. being like, okay, come on, let's do it, you know, and then boom, it's gone. I just am, you know, dropped through the bardo, gone into the dream state. The dream world is real. So right. Just suggestions.
Oh, my friend, if I had a nickel for every time this question was asked to me, look at all the smiling faces on this platform. And again, I'm not criticizing you.
No, it's cool.
This is the number one most common question outside of, in my Bardo teachings, what continues after death, right? That's the number two question. So I have written, talked about this extensively, but let me say a couple things and then refer you to some sources, right? So I don't know if you're a member of Nightclub. If you're not, don't worry. If you are a member of Nightclub,
I just joined.
Cool. So go back to, I don't remember off the top of my head which webinars, but when we first launched the program, I think I ended up doing like 50 webinars. And if you go through, we have write-ups on them. And if you look in there, you will find 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 webinars about stability. But here's, again, this is like the number one thing, connected to some of the earlier questions as well. The fact that we have so many, there's so many ways to answer this, Adam, but the principal reason that we have so many non-lucid dreams and that we capitulate to non-lucidity every night is because we have a non-lucid relationship to the contents of our mind, period, during the day. And so basically, if you really want to work with this, and this is what separates dream yoga from lucid dreaming, number one, single greatest thing you can do is meditate. Meditation is the practice of lucidity. That's why meditators have more lucid dreams. Oh, Alyssa, this reminds me. If you have it, put up the link from Benjamin Baird, my neuroscientist friend, because he wants, remember, a dear friend of mine, I'm doing a lot of stuff with the scientific community these days. Really cool stuff. I'm working with a bunch of scientists. And I've worked with Benjamin Baird, with Stephen LaBerge. Ben sent me a little survey. What?
Just a note. I'm a Zen practitioner going back 30 years, 7-day sessions. I'm, you know, sitting for an hour a day. So I got that part. And I try and use, I love the, you know, the practice, the lucidity practices during the day that you give. I've used them all the time. I'm just something, I'm losing it in the dream. I can't, you know.
Okay, well, cool. That actually then really helps me. So then the other practice that you can do that I don't think the Zen tradition has are the batteries of practices associated with illusory form. So again, there's several different things. The meditation thing is a big one. The practice of illusory form is another really big one. And then, you know, really the most important thing is, as you know, as a practitioner, is just the steadiness, the constancy, just keep going at it. Bump it up every now and again with some galantamine. Take some of this acetylcholinase, esterase. Take galantamine, 4 milligrams, 8 milligrams, every couple of weeks, every month or so. What that will do is really spike up the clarity in your dream and really increase the likelihood. And again, studies have shown this for having lucidity. Okay. Play with all these extra different techniques. Engage in programs. You know, people, when they attend programs, it's like when you start to saturate your mind in this space, you start to have it. So there is a little bit of magic involved in lucidity, but there's a heck of a lot of mechanics, causality, physics, karma. And so all the stuff I riff about in the Dream Yoga book, all the stuff in the Harbinger Press Dreaming Workbook thing, you start to really saturate work with these things on a consistent basis, you're going to start popping lucid dreams more and more. Now, it doesn't happen constantly. It's not like a clear graph curve going up. It's like the tide. It goes in, it comes back, goes in, it comes back. But slowly, it progresses forward. And so the single most important thing is perseverance, balanced with a sense of humor, levity, playfulness, and basically, you know, really powerful intention, this driving intentionality. And then also at times, like in my conversation with Ryan Hurd, you let the whole bloody thing go. Because sometimes if you're trying too hard, it backfires. The saddle's too tight. You have to release it. Often when you release it, what a surprise. I give up. Screw it. Bing. Lucid dreams start coming. It's almost like they're flipping you off, right? The principle, the lucid dreams don't abide by traditional principles. Space and time don't apply. All the stuff doesn't apply. Even patterns of effort don't apply. So sometimes to me, it's like the lucid dream is flipping you off. Like you're trying too hard, right? Ego's too involved. So that's what makes these practices advanced and subtle and difficult. They're, you know, it's really slippery stuff, mercurial. Have you ever tried putting your finger on a bead of mercury? It just slips all over the damn place. But eventually, trial and error, you find your sweet spot. You'll know how to work with these things. Okay, bro?
Thank you.
Welcome. Okay, let me just go through these in this chat column and then we're done. Hi, Andrew. Am I aging stages of life? I've not much sexual activity. Welcome to aging. Who needs that stuff anyway, man? It's overrated, right? In my dreams, like I had so many bad jokes here. I'm restraining myself. In my dreams, however, I would say that 30 to 50% of my dreams have some kind of sexual component in them. That's super common, super common. In your opinion, why is that? I can't say for sure. It's just unbelievably normal, really. Which is why, again, there's some very creative. Okay, this is an X-rated little commentary, but this is true. I'm not kidding. This when I said this, I said, "Are you kidding me?" I'm not sure if it's there, but Google it. There's actually a device you could get. It had the word rooster in it. I can't remember. I looked at it a couple of years ago and I said, "Wow, this is like really clever." But a lot of men, when they have these dreams, they have erections. And so there's this particular device. I am not making this stuff up, man. There's this particular device you can put over yourself in the appropriate place that then will actually signal, right? When you get erect, it will send a signal. It's like the dream goggle thing, but it's a different set of stimuli. I'm not making this up. And then basically through that type of association, that will then trigger you. You know, there's something, I haven't tried this. I'm pretty kinky, but I'm not kinky. It will apparently trigger lucidity because it's like, hey, wait a second. I generally don't feel this down there when I'm dreaming, right? Try it. This could be your way in, man, right? This could be like, oh my God, Andrew changed my life on that one day. Try it. I've never done it. It's there. When somebody sent it to me, I said, wow, no, this is really clever. Clever. I wonder if they got a startup campaign for this, right? Anyway, very funny in a certain way, but somebody's thought about this already. Go for it. Okay, what about people from dreams that then appear in waking life? Yeah, that's not at all uncommon as well. That's part of the fact that dreams are often, not often, dreams originate from the substrate consciousness. All phenomenal appearances arise from the substrate consciousness. And therefore, very often you have precognitive prodromal dreams that then manifest in waking life, because before that experience manifests in waking reality, it comes up through the subtle dimensions of mind. You register it as a dream. That's really common. Carl Jung talked about this as well. Gotta slow down here, trying to get through this. Oh, yeah. Nice insertion of quotes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. From Mary Rose. Bernard, it's actually a 7-part session on analytic idealism that Bernardo has offered for free on YouTube. It's effing brilliant. This guy's amazing. I'm a huge fan of his. 7-part session. It's really great. Oh, yeah. Animal World, an immense World. Beautiful book. Cool. All right, I think I got them all. Yay!
Hey, Andrew, what was the other book that you read from?
Which one, dear? I'm sorry.
There was the second book that you read from.
The only book I read from, they're both excerpts from my book, Dreams of Life. So yeah, the whole book is really, in some ways, about the union of waking and dreaming realities. So it's all about that kind of stuff. So, hey, thanks everybody. These sessions are getting rich. I hope they're not too speedy. I try to get through really deep, big questions in a short period of time. It's not so easy. So I do my best. So we dedicate the merit. If that means anything to you, the stuff we do here is not just for ourselves. It's for the benefit of all beings. Please don't forget that. It's also a very secret sauce for lucidity. You want to attain lucidity in the dream? Practice your dream yoga for the benefit of others. Wake up in your dream so you can help others wake up. So if this means anything, gather the merit. Send it out to the world. And then the usual array of events are taking place. You know everything that's happening on our platforms. But it's a total delight to be with you all. If you want to do this geeky love thing we do, you can turn on your camera, unmute yourself, and we can give ourselves this big group cyber hug, which is really corny, but it's also kind of sweet. Until then, pleasant dreams, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Andrew.
Bye.
Everyone.
Thank you.